trouble. You're sleeping in Jared's room. You must be exhausted.
I can sleep on the couch. Really, I don't want to displace anybody.
Are you kidding? I've already moved him to our bed. He's zonked out, so don't give it another thought. You're sleeping in Jared's bed, so you'll be more comfortable. Her insistence moves me, and I decide not to fight it. I eat the brownies, surprised at how comforting comfort food really is. In my family, food was fuel, but most of the time we had to fend for ourselves. I eat at least four, letting the sugar energize me. Eventually, Shannon goes to bed, and Dex shows me where the bathroom is and points me to the room where I'll sleep.
Go to bed, man. I say, I'm fine. You've done enough for me tonight. I will, but if you can't sleep, wake me up. We can watch a movie or something.
I don't know if I'll sleep, but I wouldn't wake him up for anything. I go lie down on the twin bed and stare up at the ceiling. I would really like to talk to Casey tonight, but I don't have her number. It would be good to hear her voice, to talk through this with her. She is comfort for me like the brownies, but it's a comfort I can't have right now. I hope she's all right. I wonder what she would be like as a wife. Would she be like Shannon, welcoming my hurting friends as if they're family, making brownies, fussing around to make sure they feel welcome? Yes, somehow I think she would be. I close my eyes and ask God to forgive me for my ingratitude at surviving again. I thank him for saving me tonight, for waking me up and giving me a window of time to get out of that apartment before the blast, and for helping me get to the woman in the apartment below me. I pray for her, that God will heal her and comfort her tonight. Then I pray for Casey, that as she stands on the precipice of faith, she would understand the height and depth and width and breadth of God's love for her. And mine too. Love is a striking word that I don't use often. I haven't thought of it in relation to Casey Cox until now, but it occurs to me as my adrenaline fades after a close call with death that love is just what I feel for her. I've never felt quite this way about another human being. But what if it's just the pressure and the intensity of our relationship that makes me feel that way? I ask God to give me a chance to know her without the threat of death hanging over her. I ask him to give me the opportunity to get to know her under boring conditions, to see if anything is really there. I ask him to let me be a blessing and an example to her, whatever happens between her and me. Tomorrow I'll get a new phone and email her my new number. The craving for her voice aches through me. I fall asleep and dream of us at the deer camp where I helped Dex treat her gunshot wound. The touch of her face on my fingertips. The feel of her lips when I kissed her. Unbelievably, I sleep deeply, undisturbed by my burns or the PTSD flare-up I would have expected after what happened tonight. Just thoughts of Casey. The comfort food to my mind. Better even than brownies. 16. Dylan. The next morning I go to the bank and replace my debit card. They are able to print it so that I can use it immediately. I also go by the DMV to get a new driver's license. Then I head to my cell phone store and replace the phone that everyone knows about for the third time in a matter of weeks. I follow that by getting a burner phone at the drugstore. I activate it right away. I wrestle with whether I should call Keegan to update him, but I decide to bag the idea. I can't make myself do it. I drive back to my apartment, and I'm struck again by the level of damage. There's still a fire truck there, and firefighters hosing smoldering embers. I get out of my car and stand in the parking lot looking up, wondering if they would let me go in. I doubt there's much I could salvage. Instead, I walk around to the back of the building. There's a ladder lying on the charred grass under my window. As I get closer, I can see that they've dusted it for prints. I take a step closer to the building and study the ground for footprints. After all the water that was sprayed at the building, the dirt is mud now, but I walk to where it's still dry. Nothing. I finally give up on finding Prince and go back to my car. I sit there for a moment, trying to imagine what might have happened last night. Keegan knows I'm on to him. If he suspected that I was about to take him down, he would take me out first. That's what last night was about. I wonder if Rollins got drunk because he knew it was happening. 17. Casey. I miss talking to Dylan. It's as if he's been a vital part of my days for decades, even though I've spent so little time with him. I ache with the need to resolve my case so I can go back to seeing him. But I still won't let myself talk to him, and his calls have fallen off. I get on the internet and go to the local news site to see what new things they're saying about me that might not have been picked up on the national news cycle. Tonight I'm the lead story again on Channel 3. They're rehashing the indictment and why it's taking police so long to find me. Then the anchor says, in a related story, and launches into the coverage of a fire at a local apartment building last night. I watch the footage to see if anyone I know lives there. I recognize the apartments. I used to drive past them on the way to work, but how are they related to my investigation? Fire officials say that the fire was caused by an explosion in the upstairs apartment of a local veteran who works as a private investigator. Sources told us that he's working with police on the Brent Pace murder case. I catch my breath and stumble to my feet. Dylan? Is that where he lives? I listen for them to say if he was injured, but somehow I've missed it. I back it up and play the video again, and the word explosion reverberates through my mind. I back it up again. Was Dylan killed? When did this happen? Last night? Today? Apparently, it was in the wee hours of this morning, and it says that two people were injured, including the veteran who lived there. I stumble to my purse, grab my phone out, and click on his number. It rings until a voice says that the person I'm trying to call hasn't set up his voicemail. I text, but get a message that it's undeliverable. Was the phone burned up in a fire? Is he suffering in a hospital? I consider calling his regular phone, but I don't know the number, and even if I had it, it could get him into terrible trouble. I dial the local hospital closest to his apartment and ask if Dylan Roberts is a patient there. They tell me he isn't. Tears assault me. Why did I dodge his calls for the last couple of days? I get on my email, hands shaking, and type him a message. Dylan, I just heard about the fire. Please call me. I'm praying you're okay. I hit send and wait to hear back, but an hour passes, then two, and I don't hear from him. I've never felt more helpless. I have an overwhelming urge to call his friend Dex or my sister Hannah, but my better reasoning wins out and I don't do it. Calm down, Casey, I tell myself. Get a grip. Don't do anything stupid. He'll call. He has to. I navigate to another local news station and watch their footage of the fire. I hear that the downstairs neighbor suffered severe burns, but that Dylan's condition is unknown. Fire department inspectors are telling us that they do suspect foul play. We're told that a device was thrown through the residence window and its explosion caused this fire to erupt and destroy most of the building. I'm sick, so I run to the bathroom and sit on the floor. Someone threw a bomb through his window? It had to be Keegan or one of his partners. And they'll try again. Dylan probably doesn't have either of his phones. Everything he owns was probably burned in the fire. What if Dylan's dead? No, he couldn't be. They would have said that. They just said the neighbor was badly injured, not Dylan. Could it be that he escaped the blast? God, please. I can't stand it, so I call that number again. It still doesn't go through. I check my email, but he hasn't answered. I have to do something. There's no one I can call, but I pack my bag, check out of the motel, and head south to Louisiana. If I don't hear from him by the time I get there, I'll have to do something drastic. 18. Dylan. When I call Dex to let him know I've replaced my phone, he says,
Listen, have you seen Detective Rollins today?
Last night I did. I told you I drove him home from a bar before my apartment fire.
Interesting, he says. I'm taking what happened to you personally, man, so I decided to tail Keegan and see what him and his buddy are up to. Off the clock. No charge.
I'll pay you, I say. I appreciate that.
No, it's on me, but here's the thing. Rollins is nowhere around. So I leave Keegan and go by Rollins' house, and his car's not home. Since you said he was drunk last night, I went by the bar, and his car's still there.
He's probably hungover. Hasn't gotten it yet.
I'm just thinking it's weird that they're not together after the bombing. I get the feeling Keegan is looking for you. He's been to a lot of hotel parking lots, driving through looking for something. Probably your car. But if Rollins is involved too, wouldn't he be trying to help?
Maybe he's not involved.
Maybe.
So you need a place to crash again tonight?
I smile. It's good to have friends.
No, thanks. I'm gonna get a hotel. I got my debit card replaced, so I have some cash now. Thanks for the heads up, though. I'll use our friend's method to get a room.
I deliberately don't use Casey's name, just in case someone's listening via Dex's phone.
Pay cash and claim my wallet got stolen.
Dude, you know he won't be looking for you at my house. Don't you think that's safer?
No, I don't. I don't want to keep your family in this mess. And I can stay under the radar.
What about your burns?
I can change the bandages. With one hand?
No, I'm good, Dex. I can do it.
So what about Rollins? You want me to keep watching?
Yeah, if you will.
You're officially on the clock now. Let me know when he sticks his head out.
I spend the morning filing a claim on my renter's insurance. My deductible is huge, so I go ahead and buy another computer, which I can't do without, and spend a couple of hours downloading my files from the cloud. My next stop is the bank, where I have my safe deposit box, and I load my newest files onto the thumb drive that's stored there. Then I lock it back up. Once I get in touch with Casey, I'll get her to send the pictures of my evidence sheet back to me. While I have a Wi-Fi signal, I open Yahoo and go to our email account, where I see the message she sent me today. She's heard about it on the news. My heart sinks. I didn't want her to find out this way. I write back, I'm fine. Phone gone. Got a new one, but don't have your number. I find a motel and park my car at a restaurant a block away. Then I check my email again. She's written back with her number.
Please call. I'll answer this time.
Relief floods over me, and I smile. As I walk to the motel, I program in her number, then click on it. She must be holding her phone because she answers the second it rings.
Are you okay?
Her voice is a gift that soothes my soul.
Yeah. Just a few minor burns. Are you okay?
No. I almost had a heart attack when I saw the news on the website. Dylan, what happened?
I tell her the whole thing.
I'm fine, really. I had a lot to replace today, and I'm staying under his radar. You don't need to worry.
She expels a long breath.
Dylan.
The care in her voice melts me. I could get used to it.
My neighbor below me got the worst of it. She didn't have any warning at all.
So you're the hero who saved her?
Hero is a stretch, since she wouldn't have been injured if not for me.
Keegan? Did he do this? Rollins?
Not Rollins. He was drunk. I delivered him to his door last night. No, it was a risky operation, so it was probably someone they hired. Probably thought sure they'd killed me.
Did you go to the hospital? Did you have your burns treated?
Yes. Dex stayed with me all night. I'm fine. I have some dressings, but...
Dylan, they tried to kill you.
Her voice is on the edge of panic.
You understand that, don't you?
Of course I do. Things are getting intense here. But I'm hiding.
No. You have to get out of there, she cries. You need to leave town.
I can't, I say. I'm so close to having everything I need. There was another murder. One of Keegan's extortion victims. His wife told me he failed to make a payment to Keegan and Rollins. They threatened him. That ties Keegan to more than extortion. It connects him to murder. And now the grenade and the fire? I still have to find a way to link them to that. If I leave town, nothing will happen.
This is enough, she cries. I don't want you dead. I can't take any more people I care about being murdered.
She's crying now, almost hysterically, and I wish I were there to hold her and reassure her. I know the full force of the other deaths is slamming her now. Her father, Brent, even Cole Whittington. The trauma of those deaths multiplies her worry about the attempt on my life.
I'm not dead, I tell her. Casey, I want you to breathe. Count to 20. Breathe in and out.
I don't know if she's breathing with me or not. There's silence, and I wonder if I've lost the connection or if she thinks I'm being condescending.
We're so close to this, I say in a steady voice. I have to get them. I promise you, if it looks like things are getting too dicey, I'll take it to the DA before taking a big risk. But if we wait just a little longer, if I dig a little deeper, we can connect the dots from them to all of these murders. It can happen, Casey. You'll be able to come home. You'll have your life back.
I hear her sniffing, and finally she says,
Having my life back won't mean that much if you're not in it.
My heart jolts at the reality of that. The confession anchors me.
I feel the same,
I whisper.
I want to come there. I want to help.
Stay, I tell her. Wherever you are, just stay there. I'll let you know when it's okay to come. Just trust me now. And trust God. He was with me when that grenade came in, and he's with me now.
I do trust him, she says, her voice calming. I've been reading the Bible. It's fascinating. I don't understand it all, so I bought a study Bible with a lot of notes and stuff in it, and it helps explain things.
That's good. Old or New Testament?
I ask. Both. I read from the Old for a while, and then the New. Yesterday I read all of Genesis, and last night I read Matthew.
That's a lot of reading.
Yeah, but I honestly can't put it down. And I found all these preaching videos on YouTube. I hesitate to ask.
So would you call yourself a believer yet?
She pauses. I believe, but I'm counting the cost. That's biblical, right? Jesus said to do that. My heart sinks a little.
Yeah, he did.
It's just that to whom much is given, much is required. I smile.
So now you're quoting scripture to me.
The minute I surrender, she says, I'll have to repent. That guy, the one who wore potato sacks and ate wild locusts?
John the Baptist? I ask. I think he wore camel's hair.
Yeah, that guy. He said something that kind of hit me like a baseball bat. He said, to perform deeds in keeping with repentance. Repenting means I'll have to come back there and turn myself in. But I won't live through that. It's certain death.
You can give your life to Christ and repent without running into bullet fire right away.
Can I? Is that what Christians in hostile countries do? When they know they could be murdered for converting, don't they immediately put themselves in harm's way just by professing their belief? I don't quite know what to say.
Where did you hear that?
On a video. A missionary talking about the persecution of Christians and how dangerous his work is. I think it's going to be kind of like that for me. I mean, I live in a free country where I won't be murdered for openly going to church, but my decision to believe dictates repentance, and repentance will put me in danger. So how do I reconcile that? I want to tell her that making an eternal decision like that will be worth whatever the cost is. But I don't want her to come back here and be killed. Maybe my own faith isn't that strong. Finally, I'm only able to say,
I pray for you, Casey, all the time. Let God dictate the timing, not fear.
When we hang up, I feel like I've been given a dose of one of those benzo drugs my doctors are always trying to prescribe for me. Talking to Casey makes me feel like I can do this, finish this, defeat this. I check into the motel under the name of Baxter Jones. When I get to my room, I pull out the bandages I bought at the drugstore and change my dressings,
fighting the pain. I lie on the bed and mentally replay Casey's phone call. Her caring for me is nothing short of a God thing. He's still working in my life. I see him. It assures me that he cares about me too. 19. Dylan.
I sleep until Chief Gates calls me and asks me to come in to talk to him about the bombing, and I'm suddenly suspicious that I'm walking into a trap. When I arrive at the station late in the afternoon, I see Keegan's car in the parking lot, and I can't wait to see how he plays this. Rollins's car isn't here. I feel a little sick as I walk up the long hall to the chief's office, trying not to limp. And when I step inside, I see through the secretary's area that Keegan is sitting across from the chief's desk. I clench my molars so hard the muscles of my jaws ache.
Mr. Roberts, he's waiting for you. Go on in.
My mouth feels dry and my throat constricts as I step into Chief Gates' doorway and see that Captain Swayze is there too. Chief sees me first.
Dylan, come on in. Have a seat, man.
I shake his hand and don't bother to shake the other two as I lower to the chair closest to the door. I can't even feign normalcy.
How you doing, man? The chief asks. You okay?
I'm fine, I say stiffly.
You lose everything?
Keegan asks with a note of joviality in his voice. I don't look at him.
Nothing that matters. What does that mean?
Swayze asks. His tone makes me wonder if he's in on it.
It means that I made it out. I'm okay with losing stuff. What about your injuries?
Gates asks.
They'll heal,
I say. He looks me over, but he can't see my wounds under my jeans.
Dylan, we're doing everything we can to find the perpetrator. We got some prints from the outdoor AC unit and the ladder they left. We're trying to pull the security footage from businesses around the apartment complex to possibly catch images of the person driving by. I have detectives working on all those who had access to grenades in the area. We're making some progress. I wanted you to know that.
That's more than I expected.
Who's on the case? Steele and Johnson.
Good,
I say.
I was just talking to Keegan about the Casey Cox case, and wondering if this attack on you could have had anything to do with that.
I keep my gaze locked on Gates.
And what did he say?
There's a second of silence. Then Keegan clears his throat.
I was telling him that it's possible. Maybe she did it herself.
I look at Keegan now.
Where would Casey Cox get a grenade? This girl has resources.
True,
I say.
But this was pretty physical for someone of her size. Carrying a ladder, getting it against the building, carrying a gas can up, toss in the grenade. I was thinking it was probably a man. If a woman had all that stuff and was even getting it out of a vehicle, it might call attention. But a man doing it wouldn't.
I know I should modulate my tone, that I might sound too anxious to get their focus off of her, but obviously Keegan knows I'm onto him or the attempt on my life wouldn't have happened. I'm sick of this, and suddenly I don't care if he knows it.
Again, he says, she's resourceful. She could have had help. Figured you were closing in on her and wanted to take you out.
I'm dumbfounded that he would go that far, but I stay quiet.
Where you staying, man?
Keegan asks.
Don't know yet. We want to help you find a place.
He says, all sympathetic sounding now.
Rollins and I can do some of the legwork for you. Where is he, by the way?
Gates asks.
I left a message, told him to be here.
No idea,
Keegan says.
I've been calling him all morning and he won't return my call. Car's not home, so I don't know where he is.
Dex's suspicion that something is going on with Rollins, coupled with Keegan's concerns, raises a red flag for me. Keegan knows where Rollins is. Tension pulls at my temples.
My call to Cy went straight to voicemail,
Swayze said.
Maybe one of us should go by his house and check on him.
Yeah, I'll do it, Keegan says, soon as I leave here.
Gates turns back to me.
What can we do for you, Dylan?
Find who did this.
We have to find that girl,
Keegan says, like it's settled that Casey threw the grenade.
This is getting old.
It's gone on too long,
Chief agrees.
Where are you on that, Dylan?
Close, I say.
This slowed me down a little.
The meeting is basically useless, and I feel like Keegan might have been the one to call it, to root me out. I get out to my car before he does, but he's close enough behind me that I don't leave yet. For a few minutes, we both just sit there, until he realizes I'm not leaving. Finally, he starts his car and pulls away. I give him a 10-minute head start, knowing he's waiting just up the street to follow me to wherever I'm going so he can finish the job. Maybe Rollins is actually waiting here somewhere too, hidden, ready to follow me when I leave. I get on my phone and order an Uber to meet me around the corner at a coffee shop. Then I grab my computer bag with every possession I now own, pull on a baseball cap, and walk through the cars to the shop. I order a coffee, and by the time I have it in hand, the car is there. I have the driver take me to the motel I'll be staying in tonight. I'll come back later to get my car. Dex calls me a little while later, and I pick up.
Hey, dude, what you got? Rollins is still not up, man. I've been watching nonstop. Keegan came by and banged on the door, but he didn't wait very long. I'm suspicious, man. Something's happened to that guy. You don't think Keegan did something to him, do you?
No, they're too tight. I don't see it.
Then where could he be? Not showing up at work, not at home.
Maybe Rollins has a girlfriend. Or a plane and his own mistress in some other town.
I'm gonna keep watching. I'm curious now.
All right. Let me know the minute you find him.
20. Dylan. I'm driving to Rollins's favorite drinking hole to see if his car is still there when my phone chimes. It's Chief Gates.
Hello, Chief?
Dylan? Have you heard the news yet?
His voice is somber, low. I hesitate and my mind instantly goes to Casey. Has something happened to her?
No, what?
Cy Rollins is dead.
I suck in a breath and look for a place to pull over.
What?
I half whisper.
His body was found in a shallow grave a little while ago. Shot through the head.
Murdered?
I ask.
Wait, when? How long has he been there?
Probably overnight.
My mind races.
Any leads?
We're working on it. Keegan is on the case. He won't leave any stone unturned.
I can't help asking,
you really think that's a good idea? I mean, Keegan is awfully close to things. Shouldn't it be someone more objective?
It's personal to him. He's like a dog with a bone. I'm putting another team on it too, but Keegan won't be able to focus on anything else for a while anyway.
I'm silent for a moment, but then I decide to just say what's on my mind.
I took Rollins home from a bar last night. He'd had too much to drink, and I was there with friends. I knew he couldn't drive. But I got him home safely and watched him go in. I don't know how he could have gone out after I left. If he went out again, someone had to come get him. You should get a team over there and check fingerprints on the door, see if there are any clues about who was there after he got home. Maybe he was shot at home and moved.
Keegan's on it.
I grit my teeth. I don't tell him that Keegan will hide the evidence, that nothing he uncovers will ever point to the real killer.
I do wonder if the fire at your apartment and this murder are related.
Gates says.
It did happen on the same night.
A sudden chill shivers up my back at the thought that Rollins was being murdered while I was supposed to be burning to death. Keegan would have framed Casey again, since she's the link between the two of us. It would have been all over the media. He's probably planting another murder weapon as we speak. My living threw a wrench into his plan, but it won't stop him. I do feel some relief that Keegan will be distracted from Casey now, but who am I kidding? This is all about Casey. And me too. Keegan knows exactly who threw the grenade, and he knows who killed Rollins. He may have even done it himself.
I wanted you to know, Gates goes on. Just keep working on the Cox case. Keep reporting new findings to Keegan. I'll have to assign him a new partner when things settle down, but that might take a while.
When I get off the phone, I call Dex.
You can stop watching his house.
I say.
They found him. Dead.
I tell him what Gates told me. Dex is astonished.
His partner is getting desperate. Dude, you need to watch your back. Can you rent a car? Yeah, might be a good idea. And keep using a fake name in hotels. Maybe even let me check you in so they don't have footage of you. I'm telling you, man, that guy is gonna kill you. He knows.
I decide to take him up on it. We meet up and I give him the cash. He leaves to check me into a motel that's off the beaten path. When he's got the key card, he drives to where I wait in a Walmart parking lot.
Leave your car here and I'll drive you to a car rental place, he says.
I don't know what I'd do without him. Dex gets me a rental car with his credit card in case Keegan is tracking mine. He gets the keys to a black Malibu. As I drive away from the place, I begin to worry about Casey. It's unlikely that Keegan knows where she is, which is why he's gotten desperate. She's been smart enough to stay undetected until now, but now he knows about me. He was tracking my phone a few days ago. He probably realized I was on to him then. I drive over to the bar where Rollins was last night. His car is right where we left it. I park and go in, wait to get the attention of the bartender. When he comes to me, I ask if I can see the manager. He calls to the back. The manager comes out front and I show him my police credentials.
I'm working with the police department on a homicide case, I say. A man who frequents this bar was found murdered this morning. I need to look through your security video to see if he was with anyone when he left here last night, since his car was left in your parking lot.
He frowns.
You think he was one of my patrons? Maybe,
I say. He looks worried, but leads me to his office. He's got the footage on his computer, and he navigates to it, then gets up, letting me have the chair. I fast forward through the footage, watching everyone who came out of the bar. I find Rollins' car in the parking lot, and finally I see him coming out and me helping him. I scan the other cars as I watch myself drive Rollins away. Headlights come on right after we leave, and a car pulls out a few seconds later. Keegan's car. My heart racing, I copy that part of the video onto a thumb drive, as well as the part that shows Rollins staggering out and going to the wrong car, then me guiding him toward my car. I have no doubt that this will become an issue. Keegan will use it to paint me as the killer since I took Rollins home. But my time is pretty much accounted for the whole night of my apartment fire. His obviously isn't.
21. Casey. Back in Memphis in a new motel, I go online to check the Shreveport Daily News, looking for any more information about the investigation into Dylan's attack. And then I see it. Local police detective found murdered. I click on the article and up comes a picture of Cy Rollins. I suck in a breath. He's dead. One of my tormentors is dead. I touch my heart, not sure how to feel. As much as I wanted him out of my life, the idea of his death doesn't thrill me. I would much rather have watched him suffer through being exposed and embarrassed in front of the world, doing a perp walk in a jumpsuit and flip-flops into the van that transports him to the state or federal prison. I would much rather have known he was incarcerated with people he had locked up, people who might not take things so well. But death is something I didn't expect. I read the article about how he was found in a shallow grave, shot through the head. There's even a quote by his partner, Gordon Keegan. Detective Rollins was a hero, Keegan says. I don't know what we're going to do without him. The article goes on to say,
When asked if he had any leads on who might have killed the detective, Detective Keegan answered it could be any number of people who were out to get him because of the investigations he did. We'll narrow them down one by one, and when we find this person, him or her, all the power of the Shreveport Police Department will see that they're brought to justice. I sit back in my chair, aware that he's just implicated me. The press won't need him to call my name. They will run with it themselves. Tears sting my eyes. If Keegan would kill his best friend and closest confidant and his partner in crime, then he's going to kill Dylan, too. He's already tried. There is no doubt in my mind he will keep trying. Dylan needs to get out of town. He should come where I am and stay off the grid with me. I have to get word to him and make a case he can't ignore. He won't want to. Men like Dylan don't dwell on the danger to themselves when they can save someone else. They stay in the fight until it's resolved. But I can't let him do that, if I have any pull with him at all. I pack my bag, clean every surface so I leave no prints, and pull on my wig. As I drive away, I'll call him on his burner phone from somewhere that will ping off a tower I'll soon leave far behind. I'll use every persuasive trick I can think of to convince him. I step out the front door of the hotel and cross the parking lot. My car is parked at another hotel a block away. I have to hurry. When I'm halfway across the lot, a siren blares close by. Memphis police cars fly out of nowhere and surround me. I drop my purse and lift my hands over my head as the cops jump out, shielded by their doors, their weapons trained on me. "Don't move," one of them orders, his urgent tone suggesting that he's perfectly willing to pull that trigger. I do as he says and call out, "I'm not armed."
"On your knees," they yell,
staying carefully back from me until I'm down. Someone comes up behind me and orders me to the ground, face down. I smell the tar of the pavement as he tosses my purse and snaps cuffs onto my wrists behind me. People come out of the hotel and cluster at the door, some of them filming with their phones. They watch as the police frisk me, making sure I don't have a machine gun down my pant leg or a machete under my shirt. It's the moment I've feared, the inevitable outcome of my running. It's the beginning of the end. 22. Casey. Everything has changed. I sit in an interview room that's way too cold, and there's a lock on the door and a guard standing watch outside it. They know I'm Casey Cox, the notorious fugitive who's evaded the law all these months. I'm prepared to tell them the rest of my story, including Keegan's part in it. But they put me in this room and make me wait. They're probably contacting Keegan right now to let him know I'm here. I drop my face into my hands and pray some more. "Even if I die," I whisper to God, "let the truth get out. Don't let Keegan control the story." I don't know if I'm talking to God in the right way, but I have learned that Jesus intercedes for me, and I know he'll translate my prayers into what I really need. I pray for Dylan and for Hannah and little Emma, for my mom and Hannah's husband, Jeff, and all my friends who will have to see this played out in the media. And then I pray for the media people, the ones I know and those I don't, who will cover this story. I pray for their curiosity and their doubt and their determination to dig to the bottom of it. I pray they'll see the good in me and not just accept Keegan's story at face value. Then I pray for the police detectives who will hear my story, that it will ring true to them. My dad had gut instincts that often served him well. Maybe these detectives do too. As my heart finds its normal rhythm, I linger in that prayer zone a little longer, dwelling on the privilege of coming to the Creator with my pleas. Finally, I whisper, "Lord Jesus, I believe in you." Peace washes through me. Though I'm still afraid, I know that he will not make me endure this alone. And I can pray while I'm being interrogated, while I sit in jail, and while I'm being transported to prison.
I can even pray as I'm bleeding to death. Finally, two new detectives come in. They introduce themselves like we're going to be great friends, Leibowitz and Breyer. Leibowitz has a blonde buzz cut, and Breyer needs a haircut. Breyer is carrying a bottle of water. He hands it to me as if it's some sort of peace offering. "Please listen to me," I say, trying to keep my voice steady. "I know you're thrilled to catch me, but I'm telling you, if you know the real story, it will change everything. It's not the way it seems." The detectives exchange glances, and they pull out the chairs and look at me with nothing but patience and calm, as if they want me to believe they're on my side. Always will be. But I know better. "I didn't kill Brent Pace," I say, knowing they're videotaping me and that there are observers on the other side of the glass, watching the murderous fugitive who was finally captured thanks to their skill and hard work. "Brent was killed by two cops. Gordon Keegan and Cy Rollins and whoever works with them. They also killed my father 13 years ago." I talk fast, trying to get in as much as I can before they interrupt me. "They set me up to find Brent's body, and I tracked blood all over the place because I was in such shock, and I left because I knew there was no way on this green earth that anyone was going to believe me, just like they didn't believe me when I found my father dead. It was ruled a suicide even though there were clear signs of a struggle." I stop to catch my breath. Leibowitz leans up on the table, his eyes fixed on mine. His voice is as calm as a dog trainer trying to calm a rabid dog.
"So why don't we just go back to when you found Pace's body?"
"Can we call him Brent?" I say, "because he was my friend. I didn't call him Pace."
"Tell us about that morning. What you did when you got up."
They're trying to find gaps in my testimony, contradictions prosecutors can use against me in court. "I got up like every other day, and I took a shower, dried my hair, put on my makeup and my clothes, and went to work."
"Did you stop anywhere? Did you talk to anyone?"
I try to remember. There is so much about that day I have tried to forget. "I think I stopped at Starbucks and got a coffee and a muffin. I went to work, and everyone there saw me. I'm sure they've already checked that out. They know exactly when I left."
"Did you talk to Brent that morning?"
"Yes. And I'm sure that's also common knowledge to everyone working on this case, including Detective Keegan himself. Brent called me that morning and told me he had found something about my father's case that was going to help me prove he was murdered. He told me I should come by at lunch and he would tell me. He said he was loading the evidence onto a thumb drive for me."
"Did he say what was on it?"
"No. But he said it would help crack my father's case and help me prove what I already knew to be true. And they must have been listening. They must have had his phone tapped. When they realized he was onto them, they came and murdered him, then left him for me to find. And they put that knife in my car. It wasn't mine." My eyes burn with tears, but their expressions are blank. "But they didn't know Brent had put a thumb drive in the mail to me. I was able to get it a few days later. I learned from a video on the thumb drive that he had interviewed a woman named Sarah Meadows, an evidence clerk at the police department. But after Keegan found that file on Brent's computer, she was shot to death. I'm telling you, the more you look into this, the more dead bodies you'll find. Most recently, Cy Rollins himself was found dead with a gunshot to the head." I take a breath and watch them for some sign that they believe me. But I honestly can't tell. "I know some in the media have suggested that maybe I did that too," I add, "but I wasn't anywhere near there. I've been going under the name Liana Winters. I've been living at the motel where you found me, and I've been the driver for a woman who's blind, and I've also been working for an attorney here. It wasn't me. Gordon Keegan killed Rollins, or had him killed, and he will keep killing because things are getting hot." Detective Breyer stands up, slides his hands into his pockets, and jingles his keys.
"So you're telling us that the police department itself is involved in these murders?"
"I know how that sounds," I say. "I'm not suggesting that the entire police department is involved. In fact, I know it's not. My dad was a good cop, and there are other good cops there. But I have a lot of evidence. Look in my purse and you'll find that thumb drive. But you have to make sure that Gordon Keegan doesn't get it and that he doesn't come here to pick me up. I promise you I wouldn't live to get back to Shreveport and stand trial. But that wouldn't be the end of it. There are others who have this same evidence who will release it if anything happens to me. Plug it into your computer, please. There's enough there for you to see the truth.
They look at each other, and hope flickers in my heart. God is working on this, too. It's not just me.
You say that's in your personal effects? The evidence you're talking about?
Yes, I say, hopeful. Please go get it. I tried to tell them when they were booking me, but they took it with everything else I had on me. It has an interview with Sarah Meadows, facts about other cops at the time of my father's death who were beaten or threatened, notes on an interview with the wife of a Shreveport dry cleaner who was murdered just days ago, things Keegan has bought with the money he's made, a whole other life he's living.
Detective Leibowitz leaves the room to go find the thumb drive, and I suddenly second-guess myself. Is there anything on the drive that implicates Dylan? I don't think so, but it does include the pictures of his evidence board. What if there's some metadata on the photo with the location where it was taken? I should have checked that before. Breyer humors me a little longer. I can tell he doesn't know which trail to follow, the one about Brent, the one about my dad, or the one about Keegan.
Let's go back to the day of Brent's death,
he says.
So after you found the body, what did you do?
I shake my head, not wanting him to focus on Brent and forget about Keegan. Look, I say, you guys have known bad cops. I know you have. They're a blight on the whole force. My father knew of them. I'm just asking you to consider that what I'm saying is possible. You don't have to believe me. Just check it out. Everything I'm saying can be corroborated. There's a knock on the door, and the detective looks up and someone motions to him. He slides his chair back.
I'll be right back.
I know it's going to be a long wait, and I sit there and freeze silently, continuing to pray, hoping they're looking through the files on the thumb drive now. After an hour or so, a female guard comes in and puts handcuffs on me and leads me to a holding cell. Her search of me is horrifying, but I endure it as if I'm not in my body, as if I'm standing off to the side, looking away as this other person goes through the motions. I can do this, I tell myself. I've been beaten by a psychopathic kidnapper, roughed up by a drug addict who traded his child for a hit, survived having my car rammed, and even been shot. This is easy. After I go through the degrading process of booking, they make me change into a jumpsuit and put me into a holding cell alone. It's got a bench but no mattress, and the room is even colder than the interview room. But I'm grateful for a place where I can lie down and think. I don't know what's going on or what will happen next, but I hope Dylan gets word soon that I'm in jail. Best case scenario, he will come for me. Worst case, Keegan will. And if he does, I'll be dead before we hit the city limits.
23. Dylan.
The paces are broken up about Cy Rollins' death.
Do you think that girl had anything to do with it?
Elise asks me in a voice that seems to have a permanent quiver in it. I shake my head.
No, I really don't. I think I would have found her if she were back in town.
But she's good at this, Elise says. I try to make some sense of it, how a girl like her can do the things she's done. And I just keep coming up with mental illness. How else could anyone do what she did to Brent?
The haunted look in her pale eyes isn't likely to disappear anytime soon. Nothing I do is going to banish it, but at least she might be less confused when the truth finally comes out. Jim seems lost inside himself.
If she came out of her hole and killed Rollins, or did that to your apartment, she's more deadly than anybody even thought.
I can't let that stand.
It doesn't fit any part of her profile. I think it was someone else.
How can you say that? Elise asks. She was brutal with Brent. Blowing up a building full of people to go after the men hunting her isn't that much of a stretch.
I doubt seriously if it's physically possible for her to do either one of these things. I saw Rollins last night, and he was really drunk, could hardly walk. I don't see any way she could have gotten him out of his house in that condition and taken him somewhere to kill him.
Rollins drank a lot.
Jim says. I always smelled alcohol on his breath. Sometimes he seemed to stagger. I really didn't have a lot of faith in him to find Cox. It was almost like Gordon Keegan was covering for him, trying to keep him working. That's part of why I hired you. Rollins didn't give me a sense of confidence. I like Keegan, and felt he was on top of things. Maybe Rollins just got himself into trouble with somebody. A drug dealer, or a bookie, or something.
That's a theory I hadn't expected Jim to come up with, but I don't reply. We're glad you're still on the case, Dylan, Elise says. We need you now more than ever. It's worth every penny. When they write me another check, I feel a surge of remorse, but I quickly shove the guilt back. I'm going to make sure Brent's killer gets justice. That's ultimately what they've hired me to do. And if they feel deceived after it's all over, somehow I'll pay back everything they've paid me. I'm back in my car when my phone chimes, and I glance at the readout. It's Chief Gates. I swipe it on.
How you doing, Chief?
Good, Dylan,
he says. I have some news for you. It's about Casey Cox.
I step on my brakes and pull over into a random parking lot. My gut hitches into a knot.
What is it?
She was just captured by Memphis PD.
I draw in a sharp breath.
She what? Are they sure it's her?
Positive. Someone saw her at a hotel and called it in. She was disguised, but since her arrest, she's admitted who she is.
I'm dumbfounded, and I can't even speak.
You there?
I put my car in park.
Yeah, I'm just stunned.
I rub the sweat beads on my upper lip and realize my hand is shaking. I'm glad he can't see me.
There's something you should know. She's telling the Memphis detectives that Gordon Keegan and Cy Rollins are the ones who killed Brent Pace, that they also killed her father, that Keegan killed Rollins and burned your building, basically that Keegan's Jeffrey Dahmer reincarnated.
Good. She's told them. I want to ask if they believe her, if they're taking it seriously, if an investigation is underway. Instead, I say,
really? She said that? Yeah, she's claiming she's got some things in place where this will be released to the press. I just wanted you to know since she may try to convince you of it too. Okay. Are you going to investigate her claims?
He chuckles.
Claims that one of my best detectives is a serial killer? Come on, Dylan.
My mind is racing.
I'm just saying, Chief, the press will want to know if you checked it out. In today's media climate, they're not going to treat it as a false claim. It's sensational. It'll dominate the news cycles for days. Maybe you could question her some more and see what evidence she's offering. They said she gave them a thumb drive. They're emailing me the files. Treat it seriously.
I warn him,
if the press gets the files too, and you have to assume that they will, they'll expect you to have looked into them. Just see what the evidence is so you can talk about it. Yeah, I will. Honestly, I don't know if she's crazy or if she sincerely believes this. What matters is what the press will believe, right?
I know that's not true. The truth really does matter. But I need to keep him at arm's length since I don't know whether he's in on this whole thing with Keegan.
Let me know when you get that stuff,
I say.
I'd like to know what's in the files. Will do,
he says.
Have you told Keegan she's been apprehended? Not yet. I don't look forward to telling him what she's saying. Plus, his best friend is dead. His head is bound to be in that case instead of this one. Any way I can get clearance to go get her? That's not a good idea,
Gates says.
But like you said, Keegan is distracted. I'm the most available person. You know I can do it. You're not on the force. Then put me on the payroll for a few days.
There's silence as he seems to think it over. Then he sighs.
Maybe that's the best idea. All right, I'll draw up the paperwork. Come by the office.
I hang up, so relieved I can hardly breathe. But it frustrates me that Gates isn't even considering Casey's claims. Then again, I could be just jumping to conclusions. Of course he wouldn't immediately trust the claims of a woman he thinks is a killer. And the fact that he took my advice and is sending me instead of Keegan looks good for his innocence. How will Keegan react? He won't want me to transport her. He'll want to do it himself.
He's not knee-deep in grief, as he wants people to believe, and he can't let Casey keep talking. She might make sense. I'd better get to Memphis as fast as I can. Driving's too slow. I call the airport's charter service and learn there's a corporate plane departing for Nashville in an hour. They tell me I can hitch a ride and they'll drop me off in Memphis. They charge me twice what I've had to pay before, but to protect Casey's life, I'll pay whatever it takes. I book it and pray that we depart on time, before Keegan has the chance to beat me there. Before going to the airport, I stop by the police department to sign payroll paperwork and get quickly sworn in. It's not how I wanted to come to work here, and the chief lets me know not to count on this. It's just temporary. All I need is one day to get Casey. 24. Keegan. I make sure my mourning for my good buddy Cy Rollins looks authentic, and that lots of colleagues see my grief. When Chief Gates comes up to my office personally, I expect him to give me a hug, like I'm inconsolable. He stops short of that, and instead just pats my shoulder.
You doing all right?
Sure, Chief. You didn't have to come up here to check on me. I'm doing fine.
You could take some time off, you know. You've had quite a blow.
I look down at the floor as though I'm on the verge of crying like a little girl.
No way,
I say.
I have work to do. I'm not taking off.
He seems moved by my determination.
Can we sit down?
He asks.
Sure.
I gesture toward the chair across from my desk, and he slides it back a bit and lowers himself into it. I sit down in my rolling chair and cross my legs. My foot is more jittery than I'd like, but I hide it under my desk.
What's up, Chief?
Keegan, I've got some news,
he says in a low voice. I lean in so I can hear him.
I just got a call from the Memphis Police Department.
Oh, yeah?
About what?
Casey Cox is in custody.
My heart screeches.
Are you kidding me?
Nope. Someone saw her in a hotel and called it in.
I get to my feet and look around my desk for my phone, then realize it's in my pocket.
I'll head out right now.
No, no,
he says.
I'm sending Roberts to transport her. I want you to stay here. You have the funeral and everything.
I feel the heat rising to my face, my ears.
Chief, this is big. It's my case. Cy would want me to finish what we started. I have to get her.
He just stares at me, and my mind flits around, trying to hit on a solid thought.
Are they sure it's her? Not just some crackpot trying to get their 15 minutes?
It's her. They sent us her mugshot. She looks just like herself, except her hair is dark, but we knew that. Fingerprints match. It's her.
I wonder if she's talked. What she's said, if she's poisoned my well just yet.
Has she confessed?
No,
he says, and he looks away as if he doesn't want to tell me quite everything. My gut twists, and I know with certainty that she has mentioned my name. I have to get there as soon as I can.
She's just denying her involvement. Gordon Roberts is already on his way.
I want to knock something over.
Are you kidding me? She's an escape artist. She's escaped from him before. Are you seriously telling me that you trust him with her? A guy who's not even on the force?
I hired him.
You what?
I'm sweating now, but I hope he doesn't notice.
Look, Chief, I've been working on Rollins's case, and something has come to my attention that I haven't told you yet. I was waiting until I had more. But if you're sending Dylan, you need to know.
He frowns, deep lines gashing into his forehead.
Know what?
The last person to see Cy alive was Dylan Roberts. He drove him home from a bar. I'm not saying he killed him. Or maybe I am. We just don't know. But it at least has to be considered.
No, it doesn't. Roberts had an attempt on his own life last night. His apartment burned down.
So maybe he killed Cy when he took him home before that happened.
Or maybe he thought Sai tossed the grenade and he went to confront him. I don't know, Chief. And that's why I haven't told you before now. I need to dig further. But if you're sending him to pick up a known murderer who has